they can plan ahead, make our airport safer, make our flyers safer, and have the navigations necessary.
Essential air service is protected in the FAA's reauthorization. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new legislation aimed at helping vets in Alaska.
These service members have already received this training. This will help them more quickly integrate and is very likely to lower the unemployment rate for veterans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A young woman working as a barista in an Anchorage coffee stand has been missing since Wednesday night. Few details are available, but the Anchorage Police Department is treating it as a possible abduction. APRN's Heather Arono has more.
18-year-old Samantha Koenig has been missing since Wednesday evening. A barista at the Common Grounds coffee stand near the Old Seward Highway in Tudor Road, Koenig was supposed to close up the shop at 8 p.m. But Lieutenant Dave Parker with the Anchorage Police Department says she never made it home.
Ultimately, yesterday, we got information from the family that she was a missing person, and the detectives in the homicide unit started working that case. They work our missing persons cases. Ultimately, they determined that she was kidnapped or abducted from her work. And so now we're working that case as an abduction.
Lieutenant Parker says the only details being released at this time is the suspect is male.
If there was anyone in the area of Old Seward Highway and Tudor Road, right in front of the Alaska Club there, on Wednesday night between 8 and 8:30, and saw anything like a man and a woman walking from the area, we know that they left on foot. They should call the police department right away and share what they know.
Due to the critical nature of an abduction, he says many detectives from all kinds of units have been pulled in to look for Samantha. Anyone with information is encouraged to call 786-8900. In Anchorage, this is Heather Arono.
Federally subsidized air travel in Alaska is no longer under the threat of congressional budget cutting. Today, the U.S. House passed a compromise version of the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill. It keeps the essential air service subsidy in place for rural Alaska communities, and it funds a number of airport improvements. Representative Don Young was one of the yes votes.
I think this has been well thought out. This bill will do the job, and we should have did it done for the American people. It'd be a sad day if we didn't pass this legislation because the work has gone into it and it does solve lots of problems. It gives a surety for the FAA. They can plan ahead, make our airports safer, make our flyers safer, and have the navigations necessary.
The bill ran into opposition from organized labor because it would hasten the automation of air traffic control systems. The FAA bill puts $3.5 billion per year into airport improvements. Senator Mark Begich expects quick Senate action on the bill. When he appeared on the public radio call-in program Talk of Alaska this week, he had just come out of a caucus meeting where they decided to take it up first thing next week.
Hopefully Monday. I was in a leadership meeting today, and we're talking about putting that up for Monday to vote on it. I believe once that passes, and it will pass, that, again, we got a good Alaskan provisions. Lots of money in there for airport construction, which is very important, and several what I call specific Alaskan provisions. So that's the next one. I believe we'll get to that Monday, and then next week, hopefully, we will pass that out and Alaskans should be very happy. I'm very excited about it.
The FAA reauthorization bill also exempts shipments of hospital oxygen from security regulations that would have barred them flying, and it calls for more use of remotely piloted research aircraft. Alaska's House and Senate have passed bills aimed at easing veterans' chances of getting jobs. The measures direct the state to consider military training and experience when granting professional license. Alaska licensed about 40 professions, from barbers to contractors and nurses. House sponsor Bill Thomas, a Haines Republican, says about 1,200 Alaska-based service members leave the military every year, and the unemployment rate among young vets is about 22%.
Many have already received quality training through the military, and I use an example of mechanics who have the ability to perform the duties and then have to go through the process of getting certified at the local level. And the other one is a plumber who's been in the Navy for 20 years. There's no reason for them to come back and start all over again. There's a way to help them come out, have a job, and go forward.
The bills also tell officials to grant temporary 6-month professional licenses to qualified veterans. They also direct the University of Alaska to consider military training and experience as credit toward degrees. House Bill 282 passed without opposition on Wednesday. A similar measure, Senate Bill 150, passed the Senate the same day. Senate sponsor Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says the measure recognizes veterans' knowledge.
There's no special treatment here. What this bill does is it eliminates the need for duplicative education, classes, training. These service members have already received this training. They've already received this education. This will help them more quickly integrate and is very likely to lower the unemployment rate for veterans.
The two bills are very similar, but they have some differences, such as the effective date. That means the House will have to approve the Senate's version or the other way around. Sponsors also could compromise and ask both chambers to approve a revised measure. There's no word yet on how or when that would happen. Iditarod Trail sled dog race organizers are deciding to make a change in the route for the 2012 race. This year's race marks the 40th run, and it follows the northern route. Race Marshal Mark Nordman says the race route will be altered somewhat to avoid the section known as the Happy River Steps. That area is notorious for being a deal breaker for both rookie and veteran mushers because of its steep terrain. Erin McLaurin is the Iditarod's new spokeswoman. McLaurin says there's reason for the change.
Every year, the Iditarod Trail Committee is always trying to look at ways to improve the trail. And of course, there's, you know, pros and cons to that, depending on who you speak to. But the Happy Steps has always been an area that's caused a lot of havoc on mushers, from destroying sleds to breaking collarbones. So this year, we are going to try this route. It is not a change forever at this point. Again, it's just something we are trying this year. And after the end of the race, we'll just get feedback from mushers and other folks out there, you know, if they preferred the routing or not.
The alternate route has been made available because of a mining road constructed in 2010 that runs parallel to the Iditarod Trail. The race route will use the mining road as an alternative to the steps. The 2012 Iditarod starts Saturday, March 3rd in Anchorage. The race restarts in Willow on Sunday, March 4th. 68 dog drivers are signed up for the annual trek to Nome. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, simple advice for winning the Yukon Quest.
Somebody keeps telling me all to do is don't let anybody pass me and I'll be good to go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
State troopers have arrested a man who was firing shots at a house in Brevik Mission. Nome Trooper Ann Sears says that 53-year-old Roy Henry of Brevik Mission fired 3 shots Wednesday night at around 10:30 into his neighbor's home. Sears says there were 3 adults and 3 children inside the house at the time of the shooting, which lasted for half an hour. One adult in the home was nearly hit.
It was right at chest level and only inches from his chest. A different round at a different time almost hit the responding village police officer. It almost went over his head by inches.
One bullet passed through two walls into the house and exited. Another penetrated the door and became lodged in the wall. Troopers in Nome were unable to respond Wednesday night due to ice fog. Troopers flew in Thursday morning and arrested Henry. The officers say alcohol was a factor. Mushers are finalizing their plans and race officials are checking on trail conditions as Saturday's start of the 2012 Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race fast approaches. This year's race starts in Alaska. KUAC's Emily Schwing caught up with rookie and veteran mushers as they gathered for informational meetings in Fairbanks yesterday.
Two Rivers musher Alan Moore is always wearing the same hat emblazoned with the name of the dog food he uses, and he's almost always smiling. Moore will be the first musher out of the start chute for the 2012 Yukon Quest.
Somebody keeps telling me all I do is don't let anybody pass me and I'll be good to go.
Moore and 23 other mushers gathered in a hotel conference room in Fairbanks to discuss trail conditions and last-minute details with race personnel. While Moore jokes, Christy Barrington shifts uneasily in her chair. She'll start the race second.
Well, I've heard lots of good things about Alan's team, so if I could just follow him all the way to Whitehorse and maybe a mile from the finish, we can duke it out there.
Alaska's half of the trail boasts three major summits, notoriously cold temperatures, and often poor weather. Moore ran the quest last year from Whitehorse to Fairbanks, but like Barrington, it'll be his rookie start on the Alaska side. But he's not showing any nerves. He trains his team on parts of the Alaska side trail.
They're going to be a lot perkier when they hit the mountains, so that'll be good, especially the steep mountains. And we'll have more dogs, and it won't be at the end of the race where we've already gone 900 miles. So that'll make a big difference. It'll be a lot harder just to hold them back.
But Christy Barrington has come more than 500 miles north from Kisilov, Alaska, to run the race for the very first time. She says the unknown trail might be her handicap.
For my nerves, it is. I'm always, what's ahead, you know, what can I expect? And is it as bad as they say? Is it worse than they say? And the trail's constantly changing. What might be for the front five could be way worse for the next 10 mushers.
Mushers are packing their sleds and finalizing their plans before Saturday's start in Fairbanks. They'll head down the Chena River toward Whitehorse in Canada's Yukon Territory. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
There is a winter weather advisory in effect over the Stees Highway, including Eagle Summit and over 100 miles of the Yukon Quest Trail until early tomorrow morning. Dog teams are anticipated to start climbing over Rosebud and then Eagle Summit sometime early Sunday. The weather advisory includes three checkpoints along the race trail, milepost 101, and the villages of Central and Circle. State transportation officials are urging motorists in Alaska's largest city to stay home if they can this weekend so roads can be cleared as another winter storm blasts Anchorage today. DOT officials say crews can better manage snow removal if people aren't driving on the streets. It says resources are being sent to Anchorage from around the state to help remove the snow. The storm is predicted to drop 6 to 10 inches of snow in Anchorage, with up to 15 inches on the upper hillside. Today, AC Value Centers are ubiquitous in rural parts of the state, selling everything from groceries to sporting gear to bedding. But 100 years ago, the Alaska Commercial Company was a force that played a major role in the early development of Alaska. There are plenty of detailed records about their early operations in Kodiak and Cook Inlet, but information about their Aleutian outposts has been scarce up until now. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has this story about a newly discovered trove of primary source material from Unalaska Island.
Penelope Goforth says she usually has good luck digging through other people's junk. As someone who lived in Unalaska for a decade, she's always keeping an eye out for finds that have some connection to the Aleutian region. A couple of years ago, she hit the jackpot.
I'm a known rummager. And I was rummaging around in a basement in Washington State a few years back. And lo and behold, in an old Nordstrom's bag was a U.S. priority mail bag. And inside of that were a group of these journals.
The six journals she found were written by Alaska Commercial Company agents based in the Aleutian Islands during the late 19th century. The book's edges were frayed and the covers were cased in mold. But inside was plenty of unearthed material about how AC operated in a region where they had near total control.
There was essentially no government, no civil government. So the Alaska Commercial Company, which came here in 1867, right after the sale, essentially operated as anchor, post office, dry goods store. The commercial company did it all.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has a huge archive of Alaska Commercial Company documents, 171 boxes worth, to be exact. But they only have a handful of ledgers from the Aleutians. The logbooks in Goforth's possession offer plenty of new information about the extent of AC's influence over people's lives in the area, and some of it can even get a little graphic.
In some places where there was no marshal, they also operated as the local cop shop. I can tell you one story that just kept me up all night long. I was transcribing about 11:30 at night, and I came across this reference. There had been a knife fight, and Boris had apparently stabbed Semyon in the stomach. And Semyon was brought bleeding with his intestines hanging out to the Alaska Commercial Company agent.
Goforth says that she stayed up until the early hours of the morning to find out that the AC agent had locked up the attacker in the shed, that the stabbing victim did survive, and that the attacker was ultimately let go after a couple of months. She adds that there's plenty of other gripping reading in these books. There are also stories about otter hunts, fur poaching by foreign ships, and the transport of bear skulls from Unga Island to Washington, D.C. Now, Goforth wants other people to have the chance to read these books. With help from AC and the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, she was able to spend 2 weeks digitizing over 800 pages of material. She's working on making these records available to the University of Alaska campuses in Fairbanks and Anchorage and the Museum of the Aleutians. And she hopes that just maybe her find might inspire other Aleutian history buffs to do some rummaging of their own. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge. Today on AK, the science of ice. If you've been following the news about the fuel delivery to Nome or the Bering Sea snow crab fisheries hiatus, you may recognize the name Kathleen Cole. She's a sea ice forecaster for the National Weather Service in Anchorage, and her services have been in high demand this winter. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has the story.
The Bering Sea Crab Fleet has Kathleen Cole on speed dial. Every crab captain knows the ice lady, and many of them even have her home phone number.
National Weather Service Ice Desk, this is Kathleen.
On this day, though, she's taking calls in the office. Lots of calls. The sea ice is rapidly moving south, and so Cole was answering questions like, is the ice going to cover my gear?
The main pack ice will probably stay a little bit north of you, but I am expecting it to come down to Port Moeller and then go pretty much across to south of St. George.
Crabbers' livelihoods and potentially their lives depend on knowing where the ice is. Crab pots are $1,000 a piece, so losing them is a big deal. And obviously, losing a boat is an even bigger deal.
I don't like being anywhere near the ice, if I can help it. There's nothing fun about it. It's kind of neat to go up and see it. And you see it a couple times, you go, oh, wow, that's kind of cool, but now it's not so cool to be anywhere. I've seen it, I don't need to see it again.
That was Brett Robinson, captain of the Arctic Hunter. While most crabbers have headed home for a couple of weeks to wait out this year's unseasonably large ice extent, Robinson is heading north, towards the ice. He pulls up a chart to explain.
If you talk to Kathleen on the ice desk, the ice supposedly is down at 56 even line. So that's 56 even line would be right there.
Robinson is hoping to skirt the ice edge altogether by running up to the west of the Bering Shelf, which is normally where the ice stops. But he's acutely aware of the danger of ending up in the ice.
The ice tells this boat where it's going to go. It doesn't let me. So if I have to drive through the ice, it's really stressful. I mean, the boat's creaking and groaning, and then you sound like you're going to be busting welds, and you just got to crawl your way through it.
1,000 miles away, at her desk in Anchorage, Kathleen Cole is definitely attuned to the fact that crabbers are counting on her analyses to avoid getting in that situation.
I worry about all of them.
But Cole says she can't tell them to go or not go, so she does the next best thing.
What you do is give them the best information you can for the weather or the ice in their area and let them make their decisions.
But this winter has been a test of Cole's skills as a forecaster. The Bering Sea ice extent is at a 30-year high right now, and it hasn't been easy to predict the ice's movement.
Beyond 5 days, it can change so drastically that you hesitate sometimes to put that out. In a situation like this, it's just such an incredible storm that you don't want to not put the information out that's available.
Cole faced another forecasting challenge with the Renda and Healy's journey to deliver fuel to Nome. It was her first ever attempt to lead a ship through the winter ice pack.
The Healy is our icebreaker. And when you're in the ice business, you know, being able to communicate with an icebreaker is really a thrill. It really has been an honor.
But she says it's also been a learning experience.
We tend to think that we overestimate the thickness of ice because that's one of the hardest things we do in our job. But in this voyage, we pretty much were a little light on the ice in most places.
Of course, it's a small miracle that Cole can predict the ice thickness at all, considering she uses satellite imagery to generate forecasts. But she loves figuring out how to interpret the images. In fact, that's what got her interested in ice 15 years ago.
Ice images are phenomenal. They're fun to look at. And when you do weather, you usually look at satellite images in a loop. So they're moving. And when you do ice, you look at one image very closely or several images very closely to make an ice analysis.
Cole did both weather and ice forecasting until 5 years ago when her boss retired and she took over the ice desk. She's been busy ever since.
You know, in the winter months, it's the Bering Sea fisheries. And then as that ends and the ice starts to break up, then it's restocking the West Coast and then the Northwest Coast and then the North Coast. And somewhere in between all of that, we have the whale hunting and the walrus hunts. And then in the summertime, there's research for the walrus and other species.
And Cole isn't expecting it to get less busy anytime soon. She says more and more people are traveling through the Arctic, both in winter and summertime, which means her phone is going to keep ringing.
And I love it when people say, well, isn't your job going to go away in a few years when the ice is gone? Trust me, it's secure.
For AK, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And now it's time for 300 Villages, our weekly trip around the state. Folks in this community once took a ferry to get to Fairbanks. And if you listen closely, you'll get a tip about how to win the Nanana Ice Classic. If you guessed Anderson, you're right.
My name's Randy Witte from Anderson. We're about 82 miles south of Fairbanks. I remember as a kid, you know, we always travel the, you know, Alaska Railroad and get our supplies, and then that was mainly our only means of transportation at the time was the railroad, and then naturally we had the ferry system in Nenana, so it was a pretty tough go. It was a pretty challenging way to live. At one time, you know, there was no bridge that went across the Nenana River until the bridge was built in Nenana. We all had to, you know, go across the ice in the winter, and then in the summertime you had to catch the ferry. You know, they had a daily ferry. It got to be 60 below, and yeah, I'll tell you, it's challenging. A lot of people burn wood, you know, wood stoves, wood heat, and I'll tell you, you hunker down and you just make sure that your furnaces are running and you just keep stoking that fire and watch a lot of TV, do a lot of little projects, clean your closets out, anything you can do to keep yourself entertained. Oh yeah, there's there's a few trails around, you know, and but at them types of temperatures, there's people not doing much of anything except for you might get a neighbor that calls you to help them because their furnace broke down or they need to get a little wood or their vehicles broke down. So it's a pretty friendly little town, you know. You always want to help your neighbor because you never know when you might need to call on your neighbor. Yeah, you know, everybody more or less gauges if you have the Nenana that flows in to the Tanana. And when you normally see the Nenana has gone out, you can figure about a week later the Tanana is going to go out. So that's always a pretty good gauge of when the Tanana is going to flow free for the summer. Yep, the Anderson Bluegrass Festival, yes. It's been pretty successful. We have about 3,000 people that attend that every summer now, and it seems like it's getting a little bit more organized every year. We learn a little more, you know. Our motto kind of basically is we want to keep it as a family event. We're just a small little community, and it's everybody's pretty friendly, and just stop by in the summertime. We have a beautiful park there. It's a great place to be. Come check it out.
That was Randy Witte in Anderson. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Fite and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more quirky stories about life in Alaska. I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Nome, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN Steve Heimel and Heather Arono reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on rasmussen@rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.